Welcome to this special audio supplement to a CME conference held during the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium in December. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love.
I had in front of me an 88-year-old female with metastatic disease to the lungs from a triple-negative cancer, but excellent performance status.
For this event, we asked three community-based oncologists, Drs. Stephen Papish, Alejandra Perez, and Frank Rodriguez, to be video interviewed prior to the meeting where they presented challenging cases of breast cancer from their practices and posed related questions to the faculty.
She was actually seen by the radiation oncologist, and he went ahead and ordered an oncotype. And I'd like to know how the panel feels about that, whether this is strictly a medical oncology decision.
When do you add bevacizumab in metastatic disease? Would you only use it in first line? Would you use it in second line?
Please go to researchtopractice.com to see the video replay of this fascinating meeting. But for this audio CD, I met with one of the faculty investigators, Dr. George Sledge, to chat about several of the cases, particularly with an eye on what happened during the San Antonio meeting. And at the end of the interview, I ran a few questions by Dr. Sledge that have been submitted by audience members in the live event using a PDA response system. However, we begin with the first case, a 38-year-old patient of Dr. Papish who presented with a 9-centimeter ERPR HER2-positive inflammatory breast cancer that clinically resolved with TCH, but at surgery demonstrated clusters of residual malignant cells in the tumor and nodes, and because of the high risk of recurrence, the patient was placed on a placebo-controlled trial of the TKI neratinib and is now being followed so far without recurrence. As you'll hear on the web replay, Dr. Papish wanted to know if less toxic and maybe more effective anti-HER2 treatments are on the horizon. And in that regard, to begin, I asked Dr. Sledge about maybe the biggest story coming out of the city by the river, the presentation and simultaneous New England Journal publication of the so-called CLEOPATRA trial, evaluating the anti-HER2 dimerization monoclonal antibody pertuzumab in combination with chemotherapy and trastuzumab.
So pertuzumab, like trastuzumab, is a monoclonal antibody that, like trastuzumab, is attacking HER2-positive breast cancer cells at the level of the extracellular membrane domain. However, it differs from trastuzumab in that it is interfering with dimerization of HER2 with HER3. HER2, to have its maximum activation, binds to the HER3 molecule. This dimerization leads to the downstream events that lead to increased invasion, metastasis, and cell growth. So preventing that dimerization through the use of pertuzumab is another way of attacking the molecular driving mechanism of the HER2 molecule. The CLEOPATRA trial was a trial that looked at patients with metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer who were receiving frontline therapy for that HER2-positive disease. These patients were randomized to either a trastuzumab-based regimen or to trastuzumab plus pertuzumab. I think the results were striking in that they showed a major improvement in both progression-free survival, but also what appears to be a significant improvement in overall survival for patients with metastatic HER2-positive disease. And I think it's confidently expected that based upon these results, the company that makes this antibody will be bringing it to the Food and Drug Administration later this year.
You know, I got to say, I was kind of surprised to see the magnitude of benefit there. Were you?
Well, I wasn't expecting it, but actually based upon the prior data that we had with pertuzumab, the initial results with pertuzumab as a single agent are relatively unimpressive. The results in combination with trastuzumab in later lines of therapy were interesting, but certainly not knock your socks off in the way that the current data is. And I think it probably speaks to the idea that if we're going to interfere with drug resistance, the place to do it is not at a late stage, but rather at the first time that we see a patient with metastatic disease, and presumably in theory also we'd see an improved benefit in an even earlier stage of adjuvant therapy.
And actually, one of the things that's interesting, I guess because of the timing of this study, most of the patients hadn't had trastuzumab.
That's correct. And I think that is a very interesting point and certainly suggests the possibility that in a population dominated by patients who had had adjuvant trastuzumab, these results might not be quite as good. But I think as a proof of principle and as evidence that this combination makes biological sense and therefore clinical sense, I think this data is quite impressive.
Now, you mentioned the adjuvant setting, and there is a study, the so-called AFFINITY trial. Getting back to the patient that was actually presented, again, this woman, 38 years old, 9 centimeter inflammatory breast cancer. Any speculations how we might be treating a patient like this in 2-3 years?
Well, I think it's reasonably likely that we'll be using combined therapy down the road. This combined therapy, of course, already includes the combination of chemotherapy plus trastuzumab. But we're increasingly going to see extra attacks on the HER2 mechanism. This could be either pertuzumab, it could be T-DM1, it could be lapatinib. And of course, we can't forget that we would expect the ALTO trial to be giving us results sometime in the next few years in the adjuvant setting.
And of course, that looks at lapatinib plus trastuzumab.
Correct. And based upon the NEO-ALTO data that was presented, not at the 2011 San Antonio meeting, but rather the 2010 San Antonio meeting, I think we can confidently expect that we may see some really good results there as well. I think we are going to be blessed with this almost embarrassment of riches in terms of new combinatorial therapies for HER2-targeted therapy in the fairly near future. And it suggests to me that, at least from a public health standpoint, HER2-positive disease is going to be a lot less dangerous disease 5 and 10 years from now than it was 5 and 10 years ago.
I guess we should clarify, was it your take that by adding this additional antibody, there was almost no side effects tolerability issues?
Yeah, I was impressed by how little toxicity there was. Now, we admittedly do not have currently presented a significant amount of cardiotoxicity data, and I think it'll be interesting to see whether or not in the long run there is any alteration in cardiotoxicity, but at least what was presented at the meeting was impressively non-toxic.
And you mentioned the ALTO trial. I mean, I was just fantasizing for a lady like this, T-DM1 plus pertuzumab in terms of quality of life. Of course, a young woman like this, you want to try to focus on the cancer, but it'd still be pretty striking what you might expect with the side effects of T-DM1 pertuzumab as opposed to sort of conventional chemotrastuzumab.
Yeah, and certainly we've got, again, previous data that's been presented comparing chemotherapy plus trastuzumab to T-DM1 that suggests that T-DM1 will give you similar or perhaps even somewhat better efficacy than chemotherapy plus trastuzumab with considerably less toxicity than chemotherapy plus trastuzumab. So I think we can look forward to the possibility down the road that we may not be using classic chemotherapy agents in HER2-positive disease 5 or 10 years from now.
As long as we brought that up, you mentioned the ALTO trial and lapatinib. What do we know right now about quality of life issues with adjuvant lapatinib in this situation?
Well, we certainly know that it is not a free ride to combine trastuzumab and lapatinib. And indeed, in the early going in the ALTO trial, there were considerable delays and concerns related to the toxicity of the combination. And that toxicity, of course, derives to a significant degree from EGFR-related toxicity as opposed to HER2-related toxicity with skin changes and diarrhea. And that issue, I think, has certainly continued to hamper the full use of lapatinib in combinations. Having said that, in the ALTO trial, after dose adjustments, it was certainly a reasonably well-tolerated combination.
This patient actually was on a trial of neratinib, and the doc was pretty sure she was getting neratinib because she had a lot of diarrhea. And he posed the question of, where are these TKIs heading? Do you see any of these, with all these other alternatives, maybe actually coming into the clinical situation in the next few years?
Well, if the ALTO trial is positive, then that, of course, would be the trial that would have the first shot at getting FDA approval in the adjuvant setting for a drug to be combined with trastuzumab. So if that is a positive trial in terms of its disease-free survival, that will sort of, I think, immediately become a new standard of care. I hesitate to say the standard of care, but certainly a new standard of care in the adjuvant setting. Of course, there are other adjuvant trials in combination with trastuzumab that are following close behind the BETH trial with bevacizumab, and then, of course, trials with the other agents that we've already mentioned are ongoing as well. So I think we're going to have a profusion of adjuvant data in the HER2 space in the next few years. Neil, it's going to be fascinating to ask that question of, once we have all that data available, how are we going to choose? Are we going to choose based on toxicity? Are we going to choose based on efficacy? Efficacy decisions may get very tough once one gets into the 90-plus percentile long-term disease-free survival range, which is certainly something that you might expect with some of these combinations. So where we're going in the next few years is, I think, anyone's guess, but what is pretty straightforward is that we're going to have a lot of new options and opportunities available.
What about neratinib and other TKIs? Do you see them entering the clinical space in the future?
I think in fairly broad terms, it's going to be very difficult for anything to enter this space. I look at it, you know, someone from Indiana University, where the walls are painted with platinum from our testis cancer days. Once one gets to a 90-plus percent long-term disease-free survival for a disease, it becomes very, very difficult even to perform trials that allow you to move something new into an area. And if with either ALTO or with any of the other follow-on trials, we get to that 90-plus percent range, statistically, you need huge trials to introduce something new. And you are looking for huge numbers of patients in these trials to show fairly tiny differences in terms of outcome. So from a clinical trialist standpoint, it becomes a nightmare to introduce new agents into this area.
So you mentioned the Beth trial, and I think you were alluding to the possibility that maybe Beth and Alto might be reporting, you know, roughly the same time, and conceivably that we might see two advantages, you know, either bevacizumab or lapatinib. And then how are we going to make that decision? There were some data presented at San Antonio, though, looking at the combination of bevacizumab and trastuzumab. Can you comment on that?
Sure. This was the Averil trial, and this was a trial in metastatic disease. And I actually found this a fairly disappointing trial result. There was certainly, to my mind, no striking evidence in the metastatic setting that the combination of trastuzumab and bevacizumab added any huge benefit for the patients who were being treated. And that was, I must say, a little bit surprising to me, given what we know about HER2 biology, where HER2 significantly increases VEGF production. And based upon earlier phase two trial data from Mark Pegram and the folks at UCLA suggesting that that was an exceptionally active combination in the metastatic disease setting, which I guess shows why we do phase three trials.
So I want to get to a couple other aspects of this case, but first, just another word about T-DM1. You know, we've been really hearing some exciting things just recently at the ASH meeting about another antibody drug conjugate, brentuximab vedotin, an anti-CD30 antibody, and I guess that's the first such conjugate approved. T-DM1 is not approved since at least going back to Mylotarg days. T-DM1 is not yet approved, but can you just talk a little bit about your thoughts about this class of agents? I think there's like a ton of them that people are developing. Where do you think this is heading?
Well, it's a really fascinating idea. I mean, if you look at the original use of trastuzumab, it was, of course, to modulate the HER2 molecule's activity. Instead, drugs like T-DM1 and brentuximab use the cell membrane as a target to facilitate delivery of a poison to a specific cell. And maysantine, or the DM1 part of T-DM1, is actually a very old drug. It was in testing when I was an oncology fellow, which was seems an extremely long time ago. And that agent was just not capable of being delivered to humans, to every cell in their body, but deliver it to the cells that are HER2 positive in combination with trastuzumab, and it suddenly becomes a world beater. I think we're going to see this more and more again. I think it depends, however, on having a target that is overexpressed in reasonably large numbers and reasonably specifically to the cancer cell. If you have those conditions easily met, then this appears to be a great approach in terms of killing cancer cells. We've been involved with the development of T-DM1 for several years, and at least anecdotally in my own clinic, this is a highly active agent that can keep some patients in quite prolonged remissions, having had prior trastuzumab or lapatinib-based therapies. And certainly the results that we've seen presented at meetings in the last couple of years suggest that this is also going to be a wonderful approach.
You know, with this brentuximab vedotin, they are seeing some peripheral neuropathy. It looks like it's not too terrible, but it definitely is there, which seems kind of in contrast with T-DM1, which I'm not sure that it actually causes any sort of chemo-like toxicity, does it?
Yeah, it causes some. You can certainly see a significant amount of fatigue in some patients, and you can certainly see, for instance, thrombocytopenia in some patients.
Yeah, what's the deal with the thrombocytopenia? Has that been figured out in terms of what goes on there?
I don't think we know for sure. I think the assumption certainly is that some of the DM1 is leaching off and entering the marrow and probably affecting progenitors for the production of platelets. But I haven't seen any compelling data to demonstrate that. I think that's just an assumption.
So two more points about this case before we move on. One, this was a premenopausal woman with an ER positive, HER2 positive tumor. And the doc, this is even before San Antonio, when I originally talked with him, said, you know, what's up with bisphosphonates? And of course, now there's even more up with bisphosphonates in San Antonio with another major trial, the NSABP B34 Cladrenate study reporting. Can you talk about what they talked about? There was some other data presented there, the Austrian trial survival data, and kind of how that fits into the whole puzzle.
Well, in fact, if memory serves, there were in fact four different randomized trials presented at San Antonio. They included trial results such as the ABCSG-12 results, which are follow-up on earlier results, but which are fairly clearly showing an overall survival advantage, albeit a modest one, for the use of zoledronic acid in the adjuvant setting and in a premenopausal patient population in which patients have had ovarian suppression in addition. We have the NSABP results, which are overall negative trial results, but which are specifically positive in a postmenopausal population. We have other trial data presented at San Antonio that was flat out negative, and then we have a fourth trial that again is somewhat positive. If you add to this the trial results from the Azure trial that were presented 6 months or so ago, what we have is a very confusing scenario. And whether or not we have a final answer there, I think most breast cancer doctors who weren't actually running one of the trials feel that this is an area that we're still uncertain as to the ultimate benefit of these agents.
Does that mean you don't do it?
I've done it in limited situations. I certainly haven't done it on a blanket basis. One of the suggestions that came out of the meeting this year, and you heard it both from the speakers and from the discussants, was the possibility that you needed, in essence, to be in an estrogen-deprived state for this to be beneficial. In the ABCSG-12 trial, women saw benefit when they had their ovaries shut down with an LHRH agonist. In the NSABP trial, the benefit appeared to be confined largely to a postmenopausal population. Now, that's an interesting hypothesis, if you will, but it's rather like shooting a shotgun at a wall and then drawing a circle around where the pellets are and saying that that's the target. I don't think we actually know what the target is. I don't think anyone would call this targeted therapy in the same sense as HER2 or estrogen receptor targeted therapy.
Having just returned from the ASCO GU meeting and hearing a bunch of people, including MD Anderson's Dr. Chris Logothetis, talk about the mysteries of bone and prostate cancer, you know, I really kind of wonder in terms of the whole bone microenvironment thing. You know, it's not just breast cancer. This issue comes up in a lot of tumors.
Indeed, myeloma as well, of course.
But I guess we're in the realm of waiting for more data, which I'm not even sure is going to come, is it?
I think we'll certainly have follow-up on many of the existing trials, and hopefully some of this follow-up will confirm some of the survival benefits seen in some of the earlier trials. I think kind of an interesting question looking at all of these trials, you know, if we go back to the early days of adjuvant tamoxifen, which only you and I are old enough to recall at this point, of course, many of those early trials didn't show an improvement in overall survival for tamoxifen, and I think many of us actually didn't believe that there was a survival benefit until we had a meta-analysis. And given the fairly large number of adjuvant bisphosphonate trials we have, I think with a few more years of follow-up, we actually might get some useful information out of meta-analyzing all of this data.
Yeah, actually, you're right. And it was also a real transatlantic thing where in the U.S., people were very anti-adjuvant tamoxifen, particularly in the U.K., Michael Baum, and then Richard Pito with the meta-analysis came along and proved that it actually worked.
Yeah.
So, well, actually, I do have a slight prediction about bone, which is I predict, this is kind of based on what we saw in myeloma, maybe Julie Grelo's SWOG trial, it seems like it was really well done, has a lot of patients. Hopefully, it'll have enough events, which compares zoledronic acid to two oral bisphosphonates, including cladrenate, You know, myeloma, we saw survival difference in a trial like that. And I guess if we saw something really spectacular there, and I think they are going to look at postmenopausal women separately. I mean, that's the only really big trial out there I could see that really changed this thing.
Yes, and if we saw a survival advantage, say, for zoledronic acid in that setting, I think that would be excellent confirmatory data and certainly would sway me to suggest that that should be a standard of care. The other issue, though, which I find quite interesting, of course, is that many of these trials were trials, for instance, that were pre-trastuzumab, and some of these trials allowed or included HER2-positive patients. The adjuvant therapies delivered in these trials outside of the bone therapy differed and differed in some ways that may affect the overall efficacy of the regimen. If adjuvant therapy gets better, and I say better from a HER2 standpoint, better from an estrogen receptor standpoint, better from a triple negative standpoint, what happens to bisphosphonate therapy in that setting? Does it become equally beneficial if you're doing a hugely effective job, say, of shutting down the HER2 pathway? I think it's an interesting problem.
So one more aspect to this case, as I mentioned, the tumor was ER positive, and I'm not sure how much might have come out at San Antonio this year, but we did see some data last year. And I'm curious where we are right now in terms of this issue of you have a patient with a HER2 positive tumor. You know, what's the basic difference whether it's ER positive or ER negative? I mean, other than that you've got another tool to use. But the question came up last year about the actual responsiveness to chemotrastuzumab based on hormone status.
Well, there's certainly, of course, evidence that HER2 works whether or not you're ER positive or ER negative. But I would say equally true, it appears that ER positive, HER2 positive patients have a somewhat better prognosis than ER negative, HER2 positive patients. There's also fairly impressive preclinical data that suggests that in a HER2 positive tumor, the estrogen receptor can represent an escape mechanism, a mechanism of resistance that can be upregulated when one shuts down the HER2 pathway. So co-treating the estrogen receptor pathway and the HER2 pathway certainly makes sense from a biologic standpoint, and again suggests that that sort of combination might be quite beneficial. We, of course, don't have to this date, because the HERA trial results have not given us the follow-up that we need, any good sense of whether or not increasing the duration of trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting provides benefit or not. And one could certainly imagine the possibility, based on what I just said about the biology, that you could see a different combinatorial effect in ER-positive patients as opposed to ER-negative patients for duration of trastuzumab. That's just pure hypothesizing, but it'll be interesting to see the results as they play out.
So one more question about this patient. You know, getting back to this issue of bisphosphonates, you know, one thing that people have said, I think even the NCCN, is if you have a patient who meets the criteria of the Austrian trial, premenopausal, ER positive, who's going to get hormone therapy and not chemotherapy, and I guess you could say combined hormone therapy technically, then maybe bisphosphonates should be considered. But, you know, parentheses, in the U.S., there aren't any patients like that because we always give young women chemo. Do you think that's really true? Because there are oncotypes out there, and it's being used in premenopausal women, and there are people with node-negative tumors who have low recurrence score who are premenopausal.
Yeah, there are definitely patients like that. I think the patient in the case study with the 9-centimeter inflammatory breast cancer, of course, would always get chemotherapy in the United States. But there are certainly many patients with smaller tumors that would get an oncotype, have a low recurrence score, and not get chemotherapy. And for those patients, I think it's certainly reasonable to consider that as an option.
So that actually kind of leads into the next case I wanted to ask you about. This is actually the one you discussed at the meeting. I thought it was really interesting in terms of the whole psychology of taking care of breast cancer patients. So 67-year-old woman gets a lumpectomy, sentinel node biopsy for a 3-centimeter grade 2, ER positive, HER2 negative, node negative by sentinel node, infiltrating ductal cancer. And she comes to the oncologist, but on the way over has seen the radiation oncologist who ordered an oncotype. And as verbalized by the oncologist, he wasn't too happy about it because he said, well, normally, you know, I've got this woman who's in good health, et cetera. She's got a 3-centimeter tumor. I would just give her chemo, you know, a little TC. I think he said he didn't think it was that difficult, but now he had to deal with the fact that an oncotype had been ordered. Any thoughts about this case?
Well, as I said at the meeting itself, I actually agreed with the radiation oncologist on this. I would have ordered an Oncotype on this patient. This is a patient who would absolutely positively have been a patient in the original NSABP data set, and therefore this sort of patient was included in the data that led to the generation and use of Oncotype. So if I had a 67-year-old with 3-centimeter lymph node negative ER-positive tumor, I'd order an Oncotype and I would use its results to help determine therapy. I tend to like avoiding chemotherapy in 67-year-olds if I can.
So, and actually what happened was this lady had, as it turned out, I think an intermediate score, I think it was 22, and she ended up not getting chemo, even though that was the oncologist's sort of bent in terms of what to do. What is your take right now about the, I was kind of surprised, you know, when I talked, because we've worked with this guy quite a bit, a very smart guy, and you know, I respect his opinion, but what's your take about sort of how these kinds of adjuvant decisions are getting made in clinical practice?
Well, in everyone's practice, my own as well, these decisions, first off, always represent negotiations between physicians and patients. You know, the day in which you could walk into an office with a patient and say, you must do this, I think, you know, ended several years ago. Patients who come into my office are frequently quite savvy. They've read the literature nearly as well as I have in some cases, and certainly frequently ask about tests like Oncotype. And therefore, I always discuss these options with the patient. And I think that's true in many practices as well. I think increasingly we're dealing with patients who are highly savvy, highly literate about the breast cancer literature. And so it does become a process of negotiation.
Well, there is the issue, though, about other factors. You know, in this case, the tumor is 3 centimeters, which is getting him concerned. And, you know, these data have come out now on the so-called RSPC score, trying to somehow integrate these clinical factors into, you know, along with the Oncotype. But you, in your presentation, went through some stuff that people maybe are like me, weren't aware about what you were saying, which is, if I understood correctly, that actually things like tumor size don't really trump Oncotype.
Well, I won't say that they don't trump it, but they certainly don't affect it in many cases. If you look at the data that's come out of this analysis, you know, the basic question we're asking is, to what extent is anatomy separate from, or to what extent does anatomy trump biology, or vice versa? And of course, there's a lot of biology in anatomy, and to a certain degree, if you have a lymph node positive or a large tumor, you may well be lymph node positive or large because your biology got you there, in which case the biology is the driver there. But there's also no question that big tumors are bad tumors at some level. There's no question that having a bunch of lymph nodes involved is bad at some level. If you look at the analyses that have tried to attach Oncotype to anatomy, what you see is that the major effect is to decrease the number of patients who fall into an intermediate recurrence score group. You tend to push patients in both directions, into both sort of a low recurrence score group and into a high recurrence score group, and you tend to decrease the number of patients who therefore fall into the intermediate. But in general, if you have a low recurrence score, regardless of the size of the tumor and perhaps regardless of the lymph node status of the tumor, those tumors don't appear to be tumors that are going to get great benefit from chemotherapy, nor does their prognosis appear to be hugely worse if they have a truly low recurrence score.
And kind of the opposite end of the thing, which is if you have a patient who has a high recurrence score, if I understood what you were saying correctly, it's not very likely that, you know, for example, tumor size, I guess, I don't know, under a centimeter, for example, is going to pull you down into what, low or intermediate?
That's generally the case. Now, there's likely to be some exceptions there. I would say that, you know, the databases that we're dealing with have some weaknesses. And one of the areas of weaknesses has actually been in the relatively small tumors. So, you know, if you're talking about a tumor that's 5 or 6 millimeters, there's not the enormous database there with long-term follow-up that would be beneficial in terms of telling us what to do.
But am I correct in saying, not just from the NSABP data, but from other sources of data, that in general, you see the same relative spectrum of fraction in low, intermediate, and high, and smaller and larger tumors?
Well, that's in general true. I think larger, or I should say lymph node positive tumors, probably have a slightly higher percentage of intermediate and high recurrence score tumors.
What about the patient with a node-negative tumor under a sonometer? Where, if at all, do you see a genomic predictor like Oncotype fitting in there?
It would probably depend on how small the tumor was. It's hard for me to imagine that a tumor less than 5 millimeters is ever going to benefit a whole lot from doing oncotyping, to tell the truth. But when you get up to, you know, the closer you get to a centimeter, the more comfortable I am with doing an oncotype on the patient, in part because I have a fair amount of skepticism about the actual measurement of the tumor that comes from the pathologist in many cases. You know, if we look at the SEER database and similar data from other groups, what we discover is that tumors grow in 5 millimeter increments. And when you actually speak to honest pathologists, what they frequently tell you is that they're kind of winging it when they tell you the tumor size in many cases, rather than actually putting calipers to the tumor.
So one other issue in terms of genomic predictors, your group, ECOG, presented some really interesting data looking at, I guess, some variation of Oncotype in patients with DCIS.
That's correct.
It's kind of, I'm not sure I've seen before anything like that presented. I was so happy to see something like that in DCIS. Can you talk about what you all looked at and what do you think it means?
Sure. Well, this started with an absolutely wonderful clinical trial called E5194, which Lori Hughes had presented a few years ago. This was a trial in which ECOG investigators, along with their colleagues in the NCCTG, enrolled patients who had ductal carcinoma in situ. These patients could either have a low-grade tumor or a high-grade tumor. There were differences in terms of the size that was allowed based upon whether or not one was low-grade or high-grade. But what was important about this trial was that patients had lumpectomy alone. This was not a randomized trial, but it was a very large cohort that has now been followed for a pretty long period of time. So we know which patients recur after surgery alone, and having gone to great lengths to collect tissue back then, we're now able to do analyses with tests such as Oncotype and with the newer genomic analysis that was performed as part of Larry Solon's presentation. And what the end result is that if you use the new gene classifier system, which actually doesn't use 21 genes but uses a subset of those genes that have been recalibrated specifically for DCIS, what one finds is a population of patients who you can distinguish who have relatively low long-term risk of an invasive recurrence. And I think the issue here is the issue of invasive recurrence in ductal carcinoma in situ. If one can pick out a population that has a relatively low rate of invasive recurrence using a genomic test, that's very reassuring, I think, both to physicians and to patients. And if one uses as a cutoff a 5% risk of invasive recurrence, as was done by Larry Solon, and as a conflict of interest, I should add, I'm a co-author on this presentation. One can determine at a genomic level, similar to what's done with Oncotype, that population. This is a, you know, an initial study, an initial test, but I think it's a quite exciting one. It certainly suggests that we are over-treating with radiation therapy for DCIS, something we've long suspected. It suggests that we may be able to get better at deciding who needs radiation therapy for ductal carcinoma in situ, and again, I think that's great as well.
This assay is now available and can be ordered. Can you envision situations in a patient with DCIS where you might use it?
Sure. I'm pretty comfortable with the data because I've been living with it for a fairly long time, but I don't see anything particularly surprising about the belief that radiation therapy can work differentially based upon the biology of the cancer. I don't think it's any different than chemotherapy in that sense. We saw other data presented at the meeting that I found really fascinating that looked at the effect of radiation therapy in invasive disease based upon whether or not the patient had a luminal A or a luminal B tumor. And there, as in Larry Solon's presentation, what one saw was that biology affected outcome, and that luminal A tumors, which presumably are similar in terms of their biology to low recurrence score tumors, luminal A tumors appear to get significantly less benefit than luminal B tumors in an estrogen receptor positive population.
Is the way you look at this that in the middle of all this is proliferation and like chemo radiation therapy works better in highly proliferating tumors?
I think that's exactly the case. And I, you know, if we look at all of the genomic assays, be it MammaPrint or Oncotype or PAM50 or, you know, any of the other genomic assays that have been looked at over the years, what is consistent across all of these is that the proliferation cassette of genes appears to be very important in terms of determining outcome using an anti-proliferative agent, be that agent chemotherapy or radiation therapy.
Now, in the surgical community, there's been discussion for years, Mel Silverstein, et cetera, about the issue of margins, you know, 1 centimeter like he does it, or 1 cell like the NSABP. What was done in this ECOG study, and do you think that margins matter?
Well, the ECOG study required a certain margin length around the tumor. So, you know, we didn't do a study that compared shorter versus larger margins. This wasn't a randomized trial, and the trial required everyone to have, I believe it was at least 3 millimeters of margin around the disease. I do think margins matter in ductal carcinoma in situ, as I believe they do in invasive cancer. Exactly what margin you need, I think, is a different question. I would say the emerging data, certainly for invasive disease in recent years, has been that you probably don't need a huge margin, and that a fairly small margin will suffice. But of course, that's in the setting of radiation therapy.
So I want to ask you about one more case, a memorable one for me. It was a 88-year-old, very fit, healthy woman with metastatic breast cancer who actually, you know, I was really impressed that the physician presented this case and said, you know, did I do the right thing? Because she actually had given her 5 different lines of chemo. She ended up dying. But it seemed like the woman tolerated the therapy pretty well, kind of like what you might expect in a younger woman. And, you know, she just turned around and said, you know, well, what do you all think? And I'm just kind of curious, looking back at that, what your thoughts are. You know, so many patients over age 80 in oncology practice about this kind of situation.
Well, certainly we're seeing more and more elderly patients who have pretty good protoplasm. I think that's been a trend over time. I don't give chemotherapy to many 88-year-olds. I don't think most oncologists do. But at the end of the day, I think this gets, again, very much down to discussions between patients and physicians. I think if the physician is open with the patient and if the patient feels strongly that they want treatment, then I don't think there's anything unreasonable about offering treatment. But being open with the patient, I think, also says to the patient, listen, in your age group, we know for a fact that the metabolism excretion of these drugs is different from that in younger patients, that as a result of that, the toxicity could be quite high and we could make your final days quite miserable. Is that what you want? And I think, you know, if the patient says, yeah, that's what I want, I don't think there's anything unreasonable about having discussions surrounding treatment. I think it's also reasonable to ask, should we be giving 5 lines of therapy in the metastatic setting to anyone? We actually have relatively little data beyond frontline therapy demonstrating a survival advantage for any agent outside of eribulin in the metastatic disease setting. It's really quite fascinating, despite the profusion of agents that we've had over the years. We have relatively little data in second, third, and fourth line settings.
So another issue that came up with this 88-year-old woman, and also another case presented at the symposium, was bevacizumab. And one thing we didn't know until after the San Antonio meeting, as a matter of fact, just recently in a press release, is that a major European trial in metastatic colorectal cancer is reporting a significant survival advantage with the continuation of bevacizumab on progression and switching chemotherapy. Now, as far as I know, no one's seen the data from this study yet. I guess it's probably going to be presented at ASCO. But given your history and your colleague Kathy Miller with bevacizumab and breast cancer and the whole issue of rebound anti-angiogenesis that I've heard you all talk about, I was curious what you thought about this European study.
Well, it's a fascinating result. I am familiar with the study and familiar with the press release. I don't think any of us have seen the data yet, so we don't have any idea how much of a survival benefit there is. But in the colorectal cancer case, of course, we actually have a survival advantage in the frontline metastatic setting, which is something different than we've seen in breast cancer, where we have multiple trials that have a PFS advantage without an overall survival advantage. So perhaps it's not surprising there that giving longer duration of therapy might provide more of a benefit in that setting. That has important and interesting implications in colorectal cancer. Of course, one of the arguments surrounding the C08 trial in the adjuvant colorectal cancer setting has been perhaps they didn't give bevacizumab long enough in the adjuvant setting to show its maximum benefit.
And they actually showed, I think at 2.5 years, they still had an advantage, but they lost it when they got to 3 years.
Correct. And did they lose it because they were no longer receiving the bevacizumab, or did they lose it because they lost it for other reasons?
I mean, this is the same story as the old, do you keep trastuzumab going on progression, correct?
Correct. I think it's a very similar question. It is a question, of course, that's confounded by both economics and toxicity. Economically, because it's a very, very expensive drug. Toxicity-wise, because while most of us think of bevacizumab as being a relatively non-toxic drug, the reality is that there are real toxicities with it. And in fact, in both the colorectal and breast cancer experiences, when you give it in the adjuvant setting, for instance, a significant percentage of patients fall off during the course of a year due to reasons of tolerability. So it's not a free ride to continue the drug forever. Having said that, a lot of the serious toxicities appear to be toxicities that occur reasonably early on. A lot of the issues surrounding cardiovascular events, for instance, tend to be front-weighted for patients receiving bevacizumab. Where this leaves us in breast cancer, I think, is a really interesting question that I certainly don't have an answer to. With a large number of trials not showing a survival benefit, I think we are, however, in a different situation than in colorectal cancer. And of course, in this country, the taking away of the indication of bevacizumab in breast cancer has certainly diminished enthusiasm among clinicians in general for doing further trials.
Any thoughts about biologically what the difference is then in terms of the effect of anti-angiogenic therapy or bevacizumab in breast versus colorectal cancer?
I really don't think we know. The question, I think, is this biology or does this have actually more to do with the clinical trials themselves? When you get up to a relatively long survival in the metastatic disease setting, and in the United States, this means somewhere in the range in most of our clinical trials of 24 to 30 months overall survival. For a patient receiving bevacizumab on E2100, the average duration of bevacizumab therapy on that trial was somewhere in the range of 8 to 9 months. So patients are spending 2/3 of their metastatic life off of the frontline drug. In that setting where you have multiple subsequent therapies, such as the 5 or 6 lines of therapy that you mentioned with the elderly patient, there's a quite great possibility that you would get a dilution of the effect of the initial therapy, regardless of what the initial therapy is. And indeed, there are statistical analyses to suggest that the longer the overall life of a patient, the harder it is to demonstrate survival benefit with the frontline therapy. This again brings you back to that question of duration of therapy. You know, if we reran the clock and did a trial in which patients received bevacizumab until death in one arm versus a control arm, would we have seen a difference?
And I guess also in colorectal cancer, we're hearing about the VEGF trap agent aflibercept.
Yes.
Can you explain what the difference is in terms of what that does versus what Bev does and whether there's any interest or it's been looked at in breast cancer?
Well, it's been looked at, I believe, in a phase 2 setting in breast cancer. I don't think that we have any particular evidence that any one VEGF targeting agent is better than any other in any disease that I'm familiar with, including this agent. So it's an interesting drug, but we certainly don't have any great long-term follow-up data in any large trial.
I guess from my simplified point of view, it looks like it soaks up VEGF like Bev does, but I guess it's not an antibody, it's this protein. And I guess it seems like the spectrum of the type of ligands it soaks up is a little different than Bev.
Yeah, it allows you to soak up more than just VEGF-A. It allows you to soak up other members of the VEGF family other than VEGF-A.
How's your enthusiasm level right now for anti-angiogenic strategies in general compared to 5 years ago?
Well, I think all of us have been chastened by the political and economic results as much as by the medical results. The Averill trial that was presented at San Antonio, while not widely commented on in the enthusiasm over the other positive trials, I think is certainly disappointing. I think what's going to be fascinating will be to see what happens in the next 2 or 3 years with the adjuvant trials, with trials such as the Beth trial in HER2-positive disease or E5103 for HER2-negative disease. If either of those trials is positive, well, then anti-angiogenic therapy is back on and back to being important in breast cancer. But until we have those results, I think the current state of our knowledge is that while we see a prolongation of progression-free survival, we don't see an improvement in overall survival, and that's the bottom line issue for breast cancer.
One other issue in terms of metastatic HER2-negative disease that was mentioned at the meeting by Hope Rugo was her trial, the CALGB trial, comparing paclitaxel to nab-paclitaxel to ixabibulone. I think most of those patients also got Bev. And I guess the trial now has been closed because the experimental arms aren't going to be a lot better or aren't going to be significantly better than paclitaxel. But as she pointed out, it still remains to see what's going to happen in terms of quality of life and side effects with those three combinations. Any predictions of what might be seen?
Well, we already know that none of the arms are superior to weekly paclitaxel in terms of efficacy. So I think it's reasonably likely that weekly paclitaxel will end up being the winner.
In our discussion of these metastatic HER2-negative cases, we talked about some of the research being reported at San Antonio that looks like it might have some clinical implications in the future, and one was the use of HDAC inhibitors.
This was a randomized phase 2 trial of second-line aromatase inhibitor therapy plus or minus HDAC inhibition. And it is a randomized phase 2 trial with all of the qualifiers that go along with randomized phase 2 trials in terms of overinterpreting small data sets. But it was a positive trial for the experimental arm, suggesting that HDAC inhibition is a reasonable thing to look at going forward in a phase 3 trial setting. And in the trial, the HDAC inhibition appeared to improve both progression-free and perhaps overall survival. So I think it'll be very interesting to see the results of a phase 3 trial once it's performed.
So the one final thing I wanted to ask you about that came out at San Antonio related also to a couple of the cases we've talked about is the management of people with metastatic ER-positive, essentially HER2-negative disease.
Yes.
And two trials in particular have been much discussed. One, the SWOG study that looked at the combination of an AI and anastrozole with fulvestrant, and then the so-called Bolero 2 trial looking at patients who progressed on a non-steroidal AI and then got exemestane and the mTOR inhibitor everolimus. Can you talk about these trials and what you think they mean in terms of patient care?
Well, first, they were both positive trials. The SWOG trial was interesting. It clearly showed an advantage for the combination over the single agent. I think that trial got somewhat less interest than it might otherwise have had based upon the patients who went into the trial. There was an astonishingly high percentage of patients in this trial. I think it was close to 4 patients in 10 who actually hadn't received adjuvant hormonal therapy. So this makes one wonder what these trial results actually mean. I certainly, in my clinic, in the metastatic ER-positive setting, don't have 4 patients in 10 who haven't received adjuvant hormonal therapy.
Well, I guess it seemed like most of them were presenting with metastatic disease.
Well, and again, that's kind of a strange population if you think about it. And I mean, it's certainly an unusual population. In the United States overall, no more than 3 to 5% of patients present with metastatic disease.
Well, the other thing was they got conventional dose fulvestrant.
Correct. And actually, the positive results were despite that. So I think it's interesting data. I didn't find it compelling data in the way that I found the Bolero 2 results compelling.
Before you talk about Bolero 2, is there any situation you could imagine right now where you'd give fulvestrant an AI?
Probably not. I think in large part because most of the patients that I have seen who are about to get fulvestrant have already had an AI. And again, that's a different population than the population in the study.
So how about Bolero 2?
So Bolero 2 is looking at the question of hormone resistance and looking specifically at a population of patients who've had progression on frontline non-steroidal aromatase inhibitor therapy and then go on to receive a steroidal aromatase inhibitor with or without mTOR inhibition. mTOR, the molecular target of rapamycin, is a downstream effector molecule that actually is downstream of multiple growth factor receptors in the breast cancer cell, and which we now know that we're capable of blocking with a number of agents, some of which are already on the market, many of which are still in development. And this is, I might add, a very active field of drug development. So looking at the results of this trial, we don't have mature survival data in the trial, but we do have impressive evidence to suggest from the trial that the combination gives you a significant uptick in terms of progression-free survival for these patients. So I found this a very interesting trial and one that I really want to see long-term follow-up in terms of overall survival data.
And if the agent becomes available, just based on the data you've seen so far, would you utilize it or would you need to see survival benefit or something else?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I would like to see survival benefit clearly. And clearly, if there was survival benefit, it would be something I would strongly encourage patients to do. Absent that survival benefit, I think I would do it on a case-by-case basis for the real simple reason that mTOR inhibition is not totally without toxicity, and it certainly adds hugely to expense, or as a new drug will add hugely to expense for those patients. One of the things that I think every breast cancer doctor knows is that there is no therapy that is less toxic than hormonal therapy for an ER-positive patient. So every time you add something to that, you are likely to increase the quality of life burden to the patient with metastatic breast cancer. So you have to get something real in return for that.
Have you yourself administered everolimus on a trial to a patient?
I've not.
What's your feeling, you know, in talking to people who've participated or been involved with these studies? The thing, of course, obviously this drug's out there for renal cell. What I've heard sure. about is mucositis and the occasional possibility of pneumonitis.
Yes, that's what I've heard as well. And for the average patient, I've heard that mucositis is what is the most disliked, certainly.
Right. And, you know, one of the questions from the audience was, are we going to demand to see survival benefit in order to use everolimus the same way we seem to have done with bevacizumab? What about this issue today of survival benefit in trials of metastatic breast cancer? It's been heavily debated.
Yeah, it's certainly something I've thought a lot about over the years. There are many reasons to believe that improving progression-free survival might be advantageous for a patient. There's a psychological burden to seeing your disease progressed. If your disease progresses, you're more likely to have symptoms. You're never sure whether or not the next agent you're going to receive is going to be effective or whether or not it's just simply going to add more toxicity. So improving PFS is certainly something that can have an advantage independent of a survival advantage for many patients. And indeed, if you ask the average patient, given the choice between my tumor progressing 6 months from now and my tumor progressing today, even if it doesn't change my survival, you know, the average patient, of course, is going to say, are you crazy? Of course, I don't want my tumor growing. Balancing that, of course, is the expensive therapies that don't improve overall survival. I think society, it's reasonable for society to ask whether or not it should pay for those therapies, particularly when they're really expensive. And of course, the toxicity issue. And indeed, with bevacizumab, for instance, even though the serious toxicities are rare, they are real for some patients, and that's certainly a part of the risk-benefit balance. And frankly, it's something that doctors have not been very good at discussing with patients over the years. So I think, you know, this is a very value-laden area, and once one gets into that value-laden area, I think it's reasonable to offer the patients a fair amount of autonomy.
I guess everolimus also is being looked at in the HER2-positive situation. I guess there's some encouraging early data. And I guess Brilera-1, I think, actually is HER2-positive.
Yeah, and it's also been looked at in a triple-negative setting, though I think the mTOR data in the triple-negative setting has been fairly negative, including, as I recall, a somewhat negative piece of data that was presented at San Antonio. But there's every reason to believe, since we know that mTOR is downstream of HER2, that inhibition of mTOR might add benefit to HER2.
So just a couple more questions that we got from the audience. Some of them were cases, but here's a question. What does the panel think about the markedly reduced rate of relapse in patients receiving propranolol, beta blockers?
Yeah, this is very interesting retrospective data. Of course, we don't have any prospective data in this area. It would be lovely to think that using a very, very old drug like a beta blocker that is cheap, off-patent, and relatively non-toxic, if we could show benefit in a prospective randomized trial, that would certainly be a great addition to our therapeutic armamentarium. But I haven't seen and indeed aren't aware of any trial data suggesting that in a prospective setting.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, really excited to see people looking at it. I guess Patty Gans has been one of the central figures trying to figure that out. Here's another one. What's the take of the panel on partial breast irradiation?
Well, this is another, of course, extremely contentious area. One of the pieces of data that was presented at this year's San Antonio meeting actually looked at this question and looked at a fairly large database, this not a trial, but rather a claims database, looking at the long-term outcome of patients who had had partial breast irradiation and comparing that to patients who had had more standard whole breast radiation. And what this claims data suggested was that the patients who had partial breast irradiation actually went on to have more mastectomies in the long run. And while the difference was in the single digits and while this was not a randomized trial, this raised a couple of possibilities that I think should give us a little bit of concern. Are these patients having a higher rate of relapse in breast and therefore requiring more mastectomies? Or I suppose alternatively, could partial breast irradiation, if it's being given to the wrong patients, and there's other data to suggest that it may be in many cases. Is it increasing radiation toxicity to the breast, impairing cosmetic outcome, and then actually requiring more surgery down the road? So I don't think we have a final answer there by any means, but it certainly is concerning data.
A couple other quick questions from the audience. I've seen this one a few times over the years. Do any of the faculty actually check tumor markers? ASCO guidelines say no.
Well, I never check it in a surveillance setting because I don't know what to do with that data. And indeed, these patients are frequently referred to me where they have a slight elevation or in some cases a significant elevation of their tumor marker, but are totally asymptomatic and have been scanned from stem to stern and there's nothing there. Even if that were to demonstrate to us that there is going to be a cancer showing up 6 months or a year from now, I'm not at all sure what to do with that data. So I don't get routine surveillance tumor markers. Now, that's not to say I don't use tumor markers. I use them fairly regularly in the setting of metastatic disease, particularly metastatic bony disease, where our ability to image for response in the bony disease setting, I think, is poor. And in that setting, I find it a useful way to help monitor the disease for the patient.
Circulating tumor cells?
Haven't used them. I don't object to those who do, but I've not found them particularly useful. If you look at circulating tumor cells, first off, a fair number of patients actually don't have circulating tumor cells. Among the patients who do have circulating tumor cells, I would say this is a very well-validated technology. You know, it's been reproducible. If you have a rise in circulating tumor cells, it's pretty clear that those patients will do poorly with a particular therapy. What's been less impressive to me is what you actually do with that data. Again, if you have a rising circulating tumor cell count on a particular chemotherapy drug, for instance, and you discover that 4 weeks before you would discover it on a CAT scan, have you really gained all that much? And the basic question for circulating tumor cells is, does finding out bad news early on allow you to turn it into good news? And to date, the answer is no.
So two more questions from the audience. Anything new with PARP inhibitors, or is this subject dead?
I don't think the subject is dead. Of course, we had a fairly impressively negative trial with the first of the PARP inhibitors to be looked at in a phase 3 setting. Though in retrospect, that drug was really not a PARP inhibitor, or at least not a very good one, certainly. So I would say that drug may well be dead. Whether or not PARP inhibition is dead, I think, is a different question. There's certainly compelling data in ovarian cancer that PARP inhibitors may be a benefit. However, in breast cancer, the idea that we'd be able to use PARP inhibitors for all triple-negative breast cancers, irrespective of BRCA status, we certainly don't have much in the way of compelling data to support that argument anymore.
So final question actually is a case. 26-year-old with 6-centimeter HER2-positive, ER-positive breast cancer, neoadjuvant AC times 4, followed by trastuzumab and paclitaxel. Patient has a tough time with chemo but gets through it, goes to surgery for mastectomy and ALND, final path, small foci of residual tumor totaling 1 centimeter, 3 lymph nodes with microscopic disease. Any further treatment? Or, I mean, obviously the patient's going to get trastuzumab and I guess hormones, but anything else?
Not at present. I mean, I would certainly give hormonal therapy for 5 years. I would certainly give trastuzumab out to a year, and presumably this would be a patient who would receive radiation therapy.
And I guess the question here that this person's asking is, what about more chemo?
Well, I don't have any evidence that giving more chemo in this setting would be a benefit.
Just out of curiosity, if this 26-year-old woman had a triple negative tumor or in a situation with residual disease after neoadjuvant chemotherapy, are there any situations where you use chemotherapy?
Well, we actually have an open trial for chemotherapy in this population at Indiana University where patients are randomized either to receive cisplatin or cisplatin plus a PARP inhibitor. So this is an area of active investigation in our group.
Yeah, I thought that, you know, people have talked about doing trials in patients in that situation, but I guess that's Kathy's trial.
That's correct.
But it seems like there are not that many that are actually out there that are getting done.
Aren't that many trials open, but it's a very high-risk population, and therefore it's a population where one can see a sort of a proof-of-concept result with fairly small number of patients from a trial design standpoint.
Yeah, I love that idea, though, of using, you know, platinum or some other chemo plus or minus a novel agent. That seems like a great situation to try it out in.
Yep, we're very excited about that as a possibility.
All right, George, anything you want to add to what you've said today?
You know, I think when I look at Bolero 2 and when I look at Cleopatra and I look at a lot of the other stuff that's coming along, what's fascinating to me is that, again, we're seeing this progressive separation of breast cancer into subtypes, that within the subtypes where we now have our basic therapy in hand, hormonal therapy in the case of ER-positive breast cancer patients, trastuzumab in the case of HER2-positive patients, we're now seeing the adding on of drugs to prevent the development of resistance to the primary therapy. And we're going to see more and more of that going forward. I think that's a really interesting advance in breast cancer and one that I think is going to pay off with survival advantages in the adjuvant setting in years to come.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to the community oncologists and faculty who participated in the symposium and to Dr. Sledge with reviewing it all. Please go to researchtopractice.com for a video replay of the symposium. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special audio CD supplement to a CME meeting held at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium.